It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Julie Rose, in for Mike Collins. We're going to check out the grosser side of the animal kingdom later in the show with folks from Discovery Place. They have a summertime exhibit at the museum that's all about animal blood, vomit, slime, and poop. But first, we're going to take a look at the health of the city's cultural sector itself. Museums like Discovery Place and that beautiful new arts complex on the south end of Uptown have long relied on government grants and workplace giving to pay much of their bills. But those donations fell off steeply during the recent recession. Even though the economy's begun to bounce back, gifts to the arts have not kept pace. So Charlotte art leaders are worried, and they've done what the city so often does when it spots trouble. They've formed a task force, the Cultural Life Task Force, it's called. And we have its co-chairs here today, Valicia McDowell, an attorney with Moore and Van Allen, and Pat Riley, who's president of Allen Tate Company. Valicia and Pat, thank you for coming.
Thank you for having us.
Also with us is Robert Bush, a senior vice president at the Arts and Science Council. And Robert, let's start with you, because the history of the Arts and Science Council is part of why we're here today, actually. The city and the county formed it in the 1970s, I think 75 it was, to streamline, wasn't it, fundraising for arts groups.
We're actually founded back in 1958.
Okay.
And then during the city and county's first cultural plan, which was a partnership between the city and the county and the Chamber of Commerce to look at a new economic development strategy for the city, they reorganized what was then the United Arts Council of Charlotte into what we now see as the Arts and Science Council. And determined to emphasize this public-private partnership, which the community is so well known for, with the local government dollars flowing through the Arts and Science Council to support arts and culture, the Arts and Science Council raising private funds to support arts and culture so that we maximize the volume of those dollars. And it's served us quite well.
And part of the idea, I guess, up to that point, there wasn't a single entity, I guess, that was sort of raising money for all arts type projects in the city, or to kind of combine efforts so that you didn't have every single arts group out there kind of fighting for the same dollars at the same time?
At the time, there was a national movement around United Arts Funds, very similar to United Way, where you would have a single campaign in communities. There were never as many United Arts Funds in the country as United Ways. There are about 4,000 United Ways in the country. There are about 70 at its height of United Arts Funds in the country. And we are one of the largest of those funds. But philanthropy has really changed in the last decade. And individual donors and corporate donors are much more interested in giving to very specific programmatic sort of things that they can touch and feel and say, I sent this child to summer camp at Discovery Place, or I invested to make sure that there were new costumes for the dance theater. So they like to be able to touch and feel and see that direct effect. And so this sort of gathering unrestricted dollars that then get distributed is something that is seeing sort of a real change in how people's giving patterns are. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to get ahead of that and look at how do we keep the best of what we've got, but improve on it and put some maybe other tools into the mix to be able to build a new sustainable platform to make sure that all the incredible things this community has built in the art, science, and history world are here for generations to come.
So this idea then of giving to kind of a generic arts group that will then kind of divvy it out, that money out based on, I guess, local needs or some kind of grant process has become less attractive is what you're saying?
To donors, yes.
Because I think a lot of people know of the Arts and Science Council as the box that they can check on their paycheck, right? That's what we mean when we say workplace giving.
Correct.
You can decide, you know, that a portion of your paycheck every month is going to go to the United Way, or Arts and Science Council have traditionally been kind of the two on that. But when you look at ASC's fundraising, the Arts and Science Council's fundraising, I mean, that decline is pretty dramatic. So let's talk specifically about what we've seen there. Last year, the annual drive brought in, according to your documents, $6.3 million. I know you had a couple of other initiatives
right.
that you were doing, but the annual drive itself, the annual campaign, $6.3 million. Well, that's $1 million less than the year before. And, you know, you go back to the 2000s. I'm sure, Valicia, Pat, you were here in the 2000s. ASC was routinely raising more than $10 million a year. So what happened? I guess this is a question for all three of you.
And probably a great question for Pat, since he's been so involved in the workplace giving issues.
We started this journey started a couple years ago when Laura Schulte of Wells Fargo headed up a task force that looked at workplace giving in a deep, deep dive, because it's not just Charlotte. Nationally, an employer coming to their employee and suggesting that they have not maybe just one drive a year for United Way, but maybe consider having a second or third, and leaning on an employee to support the local cultural community. There's been a pushback across the country to do that type of workplace giving, or in some cases people call it strong-arming the employee.
That, so it was, people felt, employees were starting to feel guilted into, you know, because what does a workplace giving campaign look like? Some of us, I've actually never worked at a corporation large enough to have a campaign like
well,
that.
Every good community corporation needs to give back to the community. Your customers and clients want to do business with people who give and support the community at large. The cultural sector is a huge part of the economic engine. But as Robert said, the change is that the employers are not wanting to take the time or energy to run a campaign or have the leadership to lead it, or they don't want to direct their employees to do something that they may not want to do. Better just stay away from it.
Let the individual employees just sort of do what moves them.
And then you couple it with what Robert addressed is the giver themselves, whether it's workplace giving or just one-on-one giving and donating. People want to give to something that they can feel and touch and sense and have the emotion versus to operations. So that task force with workplace giving completed its work. We just finished the vision, cultural visions plan, and we listened to every segment of this county as to what they wanted in the cultural sector, and there's a disconnect. Mm-hmm. We have to figure out how to fix this funding model, because it was private-public, and what this community, because the new southern city, lacked is that old, rich foundation, like the Lilly Foundation in Indianapolis. We don't have those old foundation monies.
Well, there's Duke and there's Levine. I mean, we're always hearing those kinds of names come forward and doing matching grants.
And the Duke Endowment is very restricted, though, in what they're giving is for. They don't support this kind of an effort. They are restricted to Duke and Davidson and Johnson C. Smith and the Methodist Church and health care and those kind of things.
The Levine Foundation. Well, the cultural campus is called Levine Center for the Arts.
I was talking about Duke before. Okay, the Levines have been exceptionally generous and continue to be very generous to this community to many, many things. But that's actually something that sort of occurred in the last decade. It's not like we've had those levels of foundation giving in the past. We're beginning to see that to be a much more important part of the funding mix. But we have the real decline has been we've lost about 36% of our funding, primarily in the gifts that came from through workplace giving. At the height, we had about 40,000 donors across the community. We're now at about 23,000 donors. And the gifts the gifts we've lost are primarily $50 and $100 gifts.
Right. I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk a bit about, you know, sort of the elephant in the room, which is the recession. I mean, people's pocketbooks were really hit. And we've also had a lot of transition in this community, a lot of new people coming in and a lot of established people sort of leaving the workplace so that they're not attached to workplace giving campaigns. And so as a consequence of that, we have a lot of new folks who are excited about being in Charlotte but don't really have as much information about ASC. They don't have the long history of workplace giving. And when there are fewer dollars in your pocketbook and you don't have that information, you're less inclined to give a big gift to ASC or, for that matter, United Way or whatever might be your workplace giving campaign. So that's been a component of this, but we're seeing, you know, improvement in the local economy, and we want to make sure that people know what we're doing, know what we're about. We want to tie this work to the work that Pat has done on the cultural visioning project with ASC. We know what the community wants in terms of arts. We just need to be able to fund it.
So, and to your point about the recession, that's where we also really saw the effect, the impact on government funding. I mean, the decline has been pretty precipitous there. The county's contribution in 2010 to the ASC was $1.8 million, and then last year it was $750,000, so less than half. Now, if government funding is going down, and if I mean, at this point, we're not seeing governments start to bump up all the money that they cut from the during the recession. So if government funding is going down, and if workplace giving is not where it once was, and we're not sure it's going to be where it once was, then what is the option? I mean, I guess that's what the Cultural Life Task Force is looking for. But I mean, is there money out there somewhere that is not workplace giving and government funding, or I guess foundation money?
We're going to look at best practices all over America. We will figure it out. We'd figure everything out in this great new southern city. We'll figure it out. There are ways. We're going to have to be creative, and we're going to have to look at different ways to fund anything. Now, you have to remember, with a recession, the recession's the elephant in the room, as Val said, but the first one out of a recession is housing. The last one out of a recession is government. So government right now is in the worst place coming out of a recession. But forget the recession. We would still be in a bad place right now, even if the recession never happened, because workplace giving, the corporations that are here are serving many big cities right now. They used to serve just us.
Right, like a Bank of America.
Like a Bank of America, like a Wells Fargo. They have many cities to support. And they can't just run a campaign in one town and not a campaign in another town. So when you bring in consistency, when a Duke and Progress merge, the dynamics of the corporate giving changes. So workplace was going to happen whether or not there was a recession. Government started to pull away long before the recession. So let's not let government off the hook there. Everything we have done in this town has been public-private partnerships. And when we go on our inner-city visits with the chamber, people just look and say, wow, it's both people giving, both sides giving. And we're just going to have to come back with a model that says, how can we keep that dream alive? Otherwise, it all falls to government like a Chicago, and everything is paid for by taxpayers, and I don't think that's what we want.
Is it possible that there's no more need for an Arts and Science Council, that having a unified model is not what we need? If people are interested in giving to individual arts groups, then why don't we just let the individual arts groups bump up their fundraising efforts and run their own campaigns?
Well, it could be that our just role changes in a different way, I mean, in a very sort of unique way. Every time we do a cultural action plan, unlike any of the other cultural institutions, the Arts and Science Council sort of puts ourselves out there and says, community, tell us what you want us to be. And then we have to change ourselves to become what the community wants us to be. And so that's part of this process. But it could be that we are more focused on raising, and which we are being very successful at, for example, raising dollars to support Discovery Place having field trips for all the fifth graders to come as part of their science curriculum, or children's theater going into the schools with pterodactyl players, or kids coming to see performances, or the symphony, dance theater, opera, combined field trip that we did for kids this spring for the first time in 3 years, or kids, a new field trip that we've launched this year that all the seventh graders have been going to the Levine Center for the Arts and seeing the Gantt Center, the Mint, and the Beckler in a day.
So instead of a fundraising body, maybe you're more of a programmatic kind of.
Well, and it's not programmatic. It's that we're raising the money to be able to pay for kids to go. I mean,
it's targeted.
It's much more targeted.
Instead of the more generic.
When we raise our education money, we pay Discovery Place $4 for every CMS kid to go to Discovery Place. Plus, we pay for the school bus to get them from the school to Discovery Place and home. So it's very much we're still in a united way, but we're funneling into very specific things.
We have to take a quick break. We're talking arts in Charlotte. You can join us, wfae.org.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Race to the Finish, presenting Three Steps to Incredible Health with Joel Fuhrman, MD, tonight at 9:30. Information at unctv.org. And Charlotte Mecklenburg Library hosting Joe and Terry Graydon from the People's Pharmacy, discussing prevention and treatment of health problems, June 12th and 13th at four library locations, cmlibrary.org. Thousands of people in the Charlotte area are still struggling to find a job months after they were laid off. For some, that search has lasted now more than 2 years. Many of the area's unemployed have college degrees and have never had this much trouble finding a job. As the economy rebounds from the recession, long-term unemployment remains a bigger problem than it's been in any other recovery of the past 60 years. We'll examine what's being done about it when Charlotte talks tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, President Obama nominates three candidates to the D.C. Federal Appeals Court, the high-stakes battle over judicial appointments.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Julie Rose in for Mike Collins. We're talking about the future of arts funding in Charlotte with the co-chairs of a new task force trying to secure that very thing. Co-chairs Felicia McDowell and Pat Riley, thanks for being here. Also, we have with us Robert Bush from the Arts and Science Council. And this task force was created, it includes appointees from the Arts and Science Council, but also from the City of Charlotte, from Mecklenburg County, from the Foundation for the Carolinas, from the Regional Visitors Authority. So it truly is a community-wide effort.
It's very broad-based, and that was intentional. We wanted the city and the county are definitely our partners in this work, and so they have been actively concerned about the same issues that we're concerned about, and they've given us great representatives to be on the task force. But we also wanted to have people from all across the community. We didn't want this to sort of be an undertaking for some particular subset of the community. We have people north, east, south, and west, different business experiences, life experiences, different access to the arts, different racial and ethnic backgrounds. It really is going to be funding for our community. So I'm really proud of that. I know Pat is as well. And we're already beginning to see the benefits of having that diverse group involved in the work. But I do think that we want to be clear, the city and the county have really been in lockstep with us in terms of recognizing that this is an issue and trying to figure out the best way forward. And I think that way forward is going to be, again, a different take on a public-private partnership.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a call. We have Megan on the phone from Charlotte. Hi, Megan. Thanks for calling Charlotte Talks.
I was listening to some of the feedback from Mr. Bush at the Arts and Science Council, and you know, I know that giving to nonprofits hasn't really dropped off much, even though, I mean, that was a decline in the recession, but it's really more giving to the arts in general, I think, that continues to be a struggle in America. And, you know, is the Arts and Science Council doing anything, or have they thought about doing anything about, you know, teaching this new generation that's so into the technological age about giving and how important the arts are to a community and you know, the life of America?
Thanks, Megan. That's a great point.
Actually, yes. August of 2011 launched a new online crowdsourcing giving platform called Power to Give, which has just crossed over raising $1 million just in Mecklenburg County alone, that groups can put very specific projects up online. ASC has raised matching money from corporations and foundations like Wells Fargo and the Levine Foundation to match specific types of programs. And then individual donors can give directly to projects that they want. It's proved so successful that we are in 15 cities across the country now where their cities are continuing to look at Charlotte to say they're reinventing the wheel down there. But that's one tool in a box that we got to have a lot of different tools. So we do believe that we have to be much more adept at raising funds in the social media world that we all live in now.
And, you know, I think to Megan's point, and Megan, thanks for calling Charlotte Talks, I think, you know, this younger generation certainly is sort of attuned to the Kickstarter, I guess, idea, which is the website where you can go on and like micro fund a project, and individual nonprofits that you allow through Power to Give, very similar model, to go on and get enough money for some specific thing that they want to do. And I guess, you know, it's maybe $200 or $2,000. And that does, I think, seem to resonate with this younger group Megan's talking about. But part of what, and I Pat, I've seen you say this in some of the documents, that we're talking about sustainability here. And when you talk about the sustainability of the arts, that's operational funding, is it not? I mean, the Mint Museum executive director the other day said, you know, since they opened this beautiful new Mint Museum downtown, that fundraising has been trending upward, but it's not keeping pace with the level they need for sustainable growth. And funding operations, funding the salaries of people at nonprofits is not an exciting – you're probably not going to see someone get on Power to Give and be like, yeah, I want to pay the executive director of Mint Museum. I'm going to click here and donate, right? So that, I guess, is that not the problem that you're trying to solve at this point?
Yes, and it's complicated. You know, in the past, we've been able to solve it by having maybe two or three pieces of a puzzle that we put together, and ta-da, we've been able to come up with the money. And that is really a testament to the tremendous leadership of folks in this community. But it's a different community now. And so now we're going to have to be very creative. We're going to have to try things that we've never tried before, and we're going to have to cobble together that funding. And we're also going to have to message differently. People are going to need to understand why it is important to support that person in the Mint Museum, and you know why it is important for us to have a symphony, even if they don't go to the symphony. And we need to also make these offerings more relevant to people in their own individual neighborhoods and communities. And I think that will really spark some additional excitement for folks throughout the community.
I need to ask maybe an uncomfortable question, though, here. I mean, Charlotte is a very aspirational city, and we've, done some really impressive things over the years. But is it possible that we have overcommitted to the arts right now? And I'm thinking about this Levine Center for the Arts downtown, which, you know, was hatched during a time when the Arts and Science Council was raising $10 million a year through workplace giving, and we hadn't foreseen the recession necessarily. The city raised its rental car tax to pay for the construction down there. There's an endowment that was raised to cover some of the operational funds, but have we... But now all of a sudden we're in a different reality. And is it possible that we have on our hands a NASCAR Hall of Fame situation where at some point, yes, we've got tax dollars that we raised to pay for the construction, but we're going to have to start subsidizing in some other way through some other tax revenue these beautiful new buildings that we built that we thought we were going to be able to sustain, and now we're not so sure.
This sector is about $200 million a year in an economic impact.
What sector? You're talking about the arts?
The arts, science, and history. 75,000 events. Our population by 2025 is going to double. 30,000 people came to Mecklenburg County each year through the recession. This population should and can support. And we are, in many cases, when we talked about in the vision plan what the community wants at large, they want these great institutions to do more outreach into the community, such as Discovery Place is doing in Huntersville. We need to reach out. Yes, the population supports what we have. In fact, we need more. The reality is that we have to, if I'm coming in here from another city, such as Chicago, the government, the public sector takes care of the whole cultural segment, period. Everything goes back to the mayor's office. Everything we do in this area has been private-public partnership. They look to the chamber, they look to the travel tourism, they look to the Arts and Science Council, they look to United Way, they look to the partnership, they look to the Foundation of the Carolinas. Every time government needs to say what should I support or not, it looks to one of its fingers, because these are going to ultimately be a public-private partnership. We're just saying here all we have to do is tweak to go back and say, okay, again, we are not centralized public funding. We don't want that. We don't want everything tied back to the government office. We want what they created the Arts and Science Council for in the beginning, why we created the Center City Partners. We created it because let people do what's best for that sector, and let's figure out how to fund it together, 50-50, 40-60.
Is raising taxes going to be a part of your cultural life task force conversation? How do we fund the arts? Let's add another tax onto something, or bump up our restaurant tax or something along those lines?
Everything is on the table. Everything's on the table, and I don't think it's going to be one thing. I think it's, as we talked about, this is going to be a puzzle, and there's going to be looking at the annual fund drive. Workplace giving isn't going away. We just have to tweak it. The Allentown Company still does an annual, and we upped it every year. Bottom line is it's leadership. We just have to retool what we've done in the past. We have to bring in some new thoughts, and we have to reinvent ourselves.
And you mentioned the growth that Mecklenburg County and Charlotte will see, but have we then – Have we gotten out ahead of our growth when it comes to the investment we put into our arts programs, and now we have to wait for the population to catch up?
No, the population's here. We have to tie the population that at one time was into the Canton, Ohio theater or the children's theater or whatever they were tied to where they came from. We have to reengage them in their new city, just like we have to do on the sports side. We have to reattach them. We have to be very creative to get all these 30,000 people a year attached to something that they love.
Yeah, Alicia.
And all due respect to the NASCAR Hall of Fame, the buildings that we have in the arts complex are being fully utilized. People love those buildings. You know, I'm thrilled that we have them, and I'm thrilled that people are coming in from outside neighborhoods, outside of this community. We have people. It is a destination for us. We're drawing in significant tourist dollars. So this isn't a we promised you X and you got something different than X. We promised you a great cultural complex, and we got a great cultural complex. The challenge is that, you know, we always knew that we were going to have to continue to pay to fund those buildings. There were some changes in sort of how that funding has played itself out, some of which were within our control and many of which were not within our control. We just need to adjust. We need to adapt. I mean, this is an example. This task force itself is an example of adapting to circumstances. So I don't think that we got out in front of ourselves as much as we did what we were supposed to do, circumstances changed, and now we need to adapt to accommodate those circumstances.
I mean, we forget how Charlotte and these major institutions, the Mint and the Levine Museum and the Discovery Place and the Blumenthal, they're not just an asset for the citizens of Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. They are a regional asset. And we also forget that the largest source of funding for the arts and cultural community here in Charlotte is earned revenue.
Meaning?
Thousands of people are going to line up to pay a ticket price to go see Grossology at Discovery Place, just like hundreds of thousands of people came to see the Mummies. And last week, the Blumenthal set an all-time record for attendance and revenue for a play, not a musical, but a play about World War I and the horses that fought alongside those soldiers in the Belk Theater. I mean, we are drawing an audience from across a very large region.
And then we can't forget MetLife, MSC, Electrolux, Husqvarna, SPX. These people would not be bringing their companies here if we didn't have a vibrant cultural sector. That's up there. That's with the airport number one. The cultural sector is right up there in the top 3-4. I would not move my corporate headquarters here and ask my families to come here if we didn't have a rich cultural sector. And guess what? That's what they have up north. I lived up north. Bottom line is, you didn't worry about the cultural sector. It was there. We're creating a new city. Unfortunately, it took 40,000 people writing checks every year, 40,000 individuals writing $50 and $100 checks. We just have to reengage those people, plus ask the government to come back to the plate, plus be creative like the new because we said people want to donate to a specific thing. They want to see the results. They want to have the tears come out. So they have to figure out how to write that $100 check to something that they can feel and see and touch. So we just have to be very creative. And we have some of the most creative people on this task force, all walks. Again, every sector of the city and county are on this project. ASC is just in the bleachers. ASC is in the bleachers on this one because this is a city-county task force outside ASC. In fact, they only have two appointees. So we're going to critique. We're going to critique what they're doing also.
Is the task force that you've created, which I understand you'll be having your first meeting, public meeting on Monday afternoon at 3 at the Arts and Science Council office, is the task force really focused on sustaining the marquee groups? I mean, it's important, you know, the things that are actually drawing that these, I guess these corporations are can go down and see, the Beckler, the Mint, the Symphony, the Opera, the Blumenthal, or, you know, what about the smaller ones that we have, the smaller that haven't been getting a lot of money from the Arts and Science Council anyway, that are, you know, small theater companies, small arts programs that are, I guess, making a difference maybe in their neighborhood or their corner of the world, but don't get the millions of dollars from the ASC every year.
The ASC historically, correct me if I'm wrong, Robert, was to help create new venues, create venues that are vital, help grow them up to maturity till they can raise on their own and grow up and exist on their own, subsidizing them to be more creative, to rise to the next level. and at the whole time cultivate new artists, new venues, and keep up with the times. It's a general balance of saying I cannot let the big groups fail or fall, but at the same time we got to be creating new funding for emerging talent, emerging arts and history and cultural groups.
So there's room for those smaller groups in this task
Has
force.
To be.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's part of the reason why we wanted to have people from all across the county participate in the task force, because one of the things that we heard most clearly in the cultural vision plan was people want to have arts offerings in their own neighborhoods, in their own corner of the county. And if we only focus on what's happening near the corners of Trade and Tryon uptown, then we're really missing the boat. And so, you know, we have to do both, and it may be that some of the larger, more venerable institutions, we're going to have to find a balance between those institutions and sort of the offerings that they can provide in the community and the smaller institutions.
And if this is a truly public community-wide effort, why does your press release then for the task force say that most of the meetings will be public but not all of them?
Well, we have only planned out the task force meetings through September, and all of those sessions will be open to the public. And that is really the learning phase of this process of, you know, how did this sector get created here? What are the data points around economic impact and the new plan that we've got? We're doing a very deep dive into looking at the funding from the public sector at the local and the state level that flows into this community.
Why would anything have to be, though, not open to the public in this process?
It's just that we haven't scheduled or set things yet. And there's you know, it could be that we may end up with some smaller groups that break out from this and are doing committee work and then reporting back to the bigger body. So we just haven't gotten all those details worked out yet.
And in just a couple of minutes here before we finish, this is a 6-month process. You're planning to make your recommendations to the city, the county, the Arts and Science Council, and all the other groups early next year. Is that going to be fast enough? Are there nonprofits that need it right now that are going to have problems? How quick can you save the arts community in Charlotte?
We're holding our own. We're finishing up our fundraising for this year and are hopeful of hitting our goal in the next week or so. There, we've been through our grants process for next year, and that process is complete, and we'll be approving grants to the major institutions and community-based programs at the June 19th board meeting of the Arts and Science Council for the year that starts July 1st. We're trying to maintain where we are now while we look to the future and build a plan. This isn't something that's going to be one day we're on this platform and the next day we're on this platform. This is going to be probably a process that takes 3 to 5 years to implement once we have recommendations.
It took 3 or 5 years to get where we are. A good example is the government. It might not be new money. Bottom line is the history museums were run by the county. The county came to the Arts and Science Council and said, would you take over the history museums? The Arts and Science Council said, yes, but you got to help us a little bit with public funding. And they said, okay, here's $2 million a year to help fund this. Well, guess what? That $2 million of funding has gone away. So
is the Heart Charlotte History Museum.
So how, you know, elected officials say, I can't commit for future elected officials.
It's all the time we have. The Cultural Task Force meets on Monday for the first time. Thanks so much to you all for being here on Charlotte Talks.
Thank you
for having us.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru in Gastonia, introducing the all-new redesigned 2014 Forester, providing more legroom and rear cargo space, a CVT transmission, and up to 32 mpg. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. And CPCC Corporate and Continuing Education, announcing open enrollment for summer classes to advance professional careers through short-term certificate courses. Registration at cpcc.edu/CCE. Coming up next in about 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show, high-stakes battle over judicial appointments. President Barack Obama nominates 3 candidates to the D.C. Federal Appeals Court. Diane and her guests will discuss how the fight over appointing judges could set the stage for a battle over the filibuster in the Senate. That's the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes here on 90.7 WFAE.
What would $950 pay for? I really prefer to think of our card paying for Click and Clack's coffee machine or their dental care or something. You know?
Perhaps the fabric in the seatbelts can be recycled into NPR tote bags.
I'm Lauren Brown.
And her husband, Lenny Hort.
And we donated our 1995 Toyota Camry station wagon to public radio.
Find out how you can help at WFAE.org. And thanks.
Welcome back. This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Julie Rose, sitting in for Mike Collins. And speaking of museums, Discovery Place has a new exhibit for the summer, an exhibit that oozes and burps and stinks. Two guests from Discovery Place, Dr. Robert Corbin, Vice President of Learning Experiences, and Joni Phillip, Vice President of Exhibitions at Discovery Place, are here to talk about animal grossology. The two of you smell just fine, so thank you for joining me today. So can one of you, first of all, tell me about these vomit munchers that I'm reading about in your materials for this event?
Sure. So you're probably speaking about the common housefly, a pretty cool organism. They actually taste with their feet, and they do not have digestive juices. Well, they don't have the anatomy and physiology of human beings where they consume food internally and then digest it with acid. They actually vomit on their food, which is disturbing. And then, you know, they also can sense sugars, high-content sugars, and travel around. And once they find food, they vomit on it, digest it, and then consume it with the proboscis.
So the vomit actually does the digesting externally to their body, and then once it's broken down, then they can take it
That's
in?
That's exactly right. It's like having a stomach outside of your body.
This is what a fly does anytime it lands on something?
Yes, it's kind of alarming, is it not? There are millions of bacteria on flies because of all the places that they land.
And this is an exhibit for children that you have.
It is
of all ages.
Of all ages. Well, so when you consider bringing an exhibit to Discovery Place, to Charlotte, what thought do you give to sort of appropriate for children? Is this going to make children want to stay in their houses all day and scream every time they see a fly? Or worse, you've got some other stuff over there that's pretty pretty intense.
So I will say that it's what Discovery Place does. You know, we take pride in having exhibits that are somewhat edgy. If we can find a jumping off point for people to enter into science, technology, engineering, and math, the world, knowledge, we're going to do it. It's actually kind of cool to think about topics that are a little bit taboo-like, because those are things that people are curious about. And it's difficult sometimes to have those conversations in formal settings, i.e. school or the dinner table. And so it's something that we do and take pride in doing. And to Joni's point, this exhibit is fascinating to all ages. I mean, I'm 52 years old. Poop is fascinating.
We're talking about animal grossology, the new exhibit at Discovery Place, open now. You can join us if you'd like to ring us with a question, 704-926-9323, or reach us online at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Joni, you're in charge of exhibits over there, exhibitions at Discovery Place. And they, as Robert mentioned, they're always really interactive, lots of hands-on. Okay, so how does that work when you're dealing with blood and vomit?
There's a lot of different exhibits that you can engage with. We have the male Darwinian frogs, which is like a pinball machine where you can shoot the babies out into the exhibit. We have quiz shows. There's microscopes that they can look into.
But not putting our hands on vomit and blood.
Well, so there's a caveat to that. So there's the actual exhibit, which is interactive with animatronics, but also throughout the museum we've taken on the grossology theme. And so we have our Explore More Life Lab downstairs where we have a number of animals that you can interact with. Different
live
organisms.
Animals.
Live animals. You can get up close with the donkey dung sea cucumber.
The what?
Donkey dung sea cucumber.
This is an underwater.
It is an animal that lives in the water. And in our lab, you can actually hold it under the water. And its name reflects how it looks. It looks like donkey
dung.
Doo-doo.
Okay.
And it's very slimy. It's a sea cucumber, so it emits a lot of slime, so you can interact with that. We have a number of other
is
live animals.
Is this the one that also actually has one hole in its
yes.
body? So everything it takes in and everything it puts out comes
it
in and out.
It poops and eats through the same hole.
Wow. You're letting kids hold these?
Yes, we do. after they wash their hands and they place it under the water. We have a number of other different animals. We have Baldwin, the hairless rat, that you can interact with. Huh. We have hissing cockroaches. And then spread throughout the museum, we have actual demonstrations going on. So there's the dung ball rally, where you can do an obstacle course. Certain demonstrations have where we invite our guests to eat a bug, where they can eat a chocolate-covered mealworm or a cricket.
Mm.
We have a wonderful show that's been produced by our staff, that written and produced. We have actors on staff, and it's a 30-minute show that happens on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and it's called Sam Skunk and the Case of the Amulet of the Midas. So aside from just the exhibition, we have a lot of programming going all the way throughout the museum that supports the exhibit.
So if you want to time it to be there for one of these extra shows, you just need to check the website, Discovery Place.
Right. And so we have, as Joni mentioned, we have guided, what we call guided discoveries too. We actually have random acts of science. Huh. And so one of our staff members, Carla Davis, did an extraordinary job with a couple of these. So kids, so it's important to note that this exhibit is about, presenting science in terms that kids have fun with. You know, we exist to ignite wonder. And science is naturally fun. So one of my favorites that Carla developed is the opportunity to actually create fake vomit. Vultures actually vomit as a defense mechanism.
Vultures
turkey vomit. Vulture,
yeah, exactly. So, and they're not the only ones. So if you want to come and enjoy the opportunity to make vomit at Discovery Place, we welcome you.
Make vomit.
Yes.
Yes, it's the vomit toss, the turkey vulture vomit toss.
How does that work?
So you actually get a formula of borax, and you add some other ingredients to make it look realistic, and then you have the opportunity to fling your vomit at things that would actually be threatening to your life. It's really quite an interactive, interesting, hands-on opportunity.
Tell me about this exhibit, the animal grossology. I mean, this is not something that you've supplemented with some of your own creativity, mm-hmm. but this is a traveling exhibit, is it not?
It's a traveling exhibit. It was produced by Advanced Animations, and it is based on a series of books. The author is Sylvia Bronzai, and she has a grossology series. And her history, actually, Sylvia.
These picture books?
Yes. Well, and reading. They're actual reading books with pictures, the grossology series. You can find those at our gift shop. You can find them at bookstores around the county. I know Park Road Books, as a matter of fact, brought in the series. Sylvia's background, she taught science at all grade levels in her career. And then for a number of years, she worked with the Lawrence Hall of Science doing outreach, and then returned and got her master's in microbiology. And then with her teaching with kids, both in the formal setting in schools and informal setting in science centers, she came up with the animal grossology series.
Mm.
And then paired with Advanced Animations to actually bring the book to life. So these are very large scale exhibits with animatronics and animals and bugs moving, along with video and interactives.
And is this an extra fee on top of the Discovery Place admission?
No, it's not. This you have access to the exhibit with your general admission ticket.
Okay, great. As you've been prepping for this exhibit and kind of exploring it yourself as you go along, what has sort of shocked or surprised you? What little factoid did you not realize, Joni?
Let me think.
I can step in if I can. Right. What I love is all that can be learned by the shape and consistency of poop.
Robert's an expert on this area.
I actually discovered that there's a scale called the Bristol Stool Chart.
Wow.
You can actually look at the consistency and regularity and mass and contents of poop to determine a great deal about, you know, the health of a living organism. And so I just cannot believe all that is out there. There's a whole body of knowledge related to poop.
And a whole section of the exhibit about poop, right?
There is a whole section of the exhibit on poop where you'll be able to go in and observe different types of poop and then try to be a detective and find out who left the poop.
Oh.
And so different animals have different lifestyles. You have omnivores that eat both plant and meat. You have herbivores that just eat plants. And you have carnivores that just eat meat. And their poop is all very different. And so just by studying that poop, you can find clues of what's in that poop, how that poop is formed, to help identify what the animal is.
And what's the appropriate age range for this exhibit?
We'd say children up through 14 is an appropriate age. Young?
As young as?
Oh, I'd say as young as 2 and 3, 4
really?
For that. Yes. I mean, it's a fun,
at an age where poop is still a bad word and they get a kick out of harassing their parents by saying it over and over and over again. The poor parents are going to have to be prepared for a lot of new words when
the
they come
MP
out of it.
The MP rating on this might be unsuitable for adults.
Unsuitable for adults. I was going to ask, though, does it carry some kind of a rating, some kind of a parental warning that, you know, stuff that you may be a little uncomfortable talking to your kids about is going to be broached in this exhibit?
Absolutely not.
It doesn't. Okay.
This is all about science, and it's how we live and how organisms live on this planet.
Slap the word science on there and everything is fair, right?
No, sir. The process
is... serious. I mean, it's done in a fun, lighthearted manner, but it is chock full of science and interesting facts and factoids about animals. You have also sections on parasites, and not just parasites, how it affects animals, but there's a section on the tapeworm that can have a massive impact on humans.
No, I have not seen this exhibit, but I saw that you had a section on the tapeworm, and I read about it, and I need to call foul on that, because that is tremendously disgusting to have a 3D video where you can watch a tapeworm inside a person's intestine.
Actually, it's fascinating. People don't realize that even you can be a 5-foot individual, but you could be harboring a 60-foot tapeworm. The tapeworms lodge into the intestines, and if you see their head, and there's a beautiful video where you can see with nice little hooks on it.
Beautiful video. I'm sure
it
it's
is
beautiful.
and the hooks embed into the intestine. And then people say, well, then how can you have a 60-foot worm? How could it fit into your body? Well, it folds up in the intestines, but that can also create problems because sometimes as it gets longer, it can ball up and get so big that it could rupture the intestines.
Oh, yeah, no, I would say it's a problem no matter what. Even if it's a tiny little one in your intestine, that's
but
a problem.
Even if it's a tiny little one, the other bad thing about it is it sits inside your body and it robs you of nutrients.
Right.
So not just the fact that there's something huge inside of there, but the other thing is it sits there as a parasite and it literally takes out all your nutrients.
And what are kids learning from this?
So I mean, it's really important to point out that these processes and these structures and so forth are not unique to animals. You know, it is the exception, those organisms that do not have parasites, worms, bacteria, et cetera. That is absolutely connected to human biology.
Mm. I do just need to say that when I was a high schooler in my biology class, they showed us a video on parasites and a worm that they were pulling out of someone's leg and talked about how you could get this from walking barefoot in rice paddies in some Asian country somewhere. And I, to this day, have a hard time walking barefoot on grass because I am afraid of that parasite coming out of my leg. So, you could be potentially causing some phobias in some children with this exhibit.
Well, not necessarily just phobias. It's understanding how life works and how organisms survive. It is true. There can be some nasty, bad effects. For example, you even talk about the mosquito. The mosquito is featured in there, and the mosquito sucks blood. I mean, the mosquito can also transmit disease. One of the biggest that hits around the world is malaria. Not so much in this country, but in others, it's a huge health risk. So part of it also is letting children and adults understand the life cycle of some of these organisms and how to protect yourself against them. A lot of the parasites are foodborne or pass through not washing your hands. So it's also educating in a fun way how to also stay healthy.
Mm.
But not all of it is parasites or other animals. They just go about their daily days doing massive tasks. And I'm going to throw that one over to Robert. On the dung beetle.
Oh, so dung beetles are amazing too. There have been almost 30 species that have been identified in cow fields in North Carolina, and dung beetles do a range of things. It's not just...
They actually exist in North Carolina.
They exist, definitely.
Oh, yes.
Oh.
Yeah, so
I thought these were off in exotic lands.
No.
So Coleoptera is the largest order of insects, and there are, you know, just millions and millions of them. But what I love is the behavior of dung beetles. Some of them roll them. Others wait for those that
roll
dung balls together.
Dung balls, poo balls.
They create
snowballs of poo.
That's right.
Balls of poo.
Wow.
Others actually steal the balls from those that have been created. Others dig into the dung ball itself, yet others dig into the soil underneath. So there's this whole fascinating ecosystem surrounding poop.
And others use the dung balls to lay their eggs, and it's a nest for their babies. And so they can eat, and it's a nutrient
There's
for
a
them.
Really cool cultural connection. You know, the Egyptians looked at the dung beetles, the scarab beetles, which are revered in that culture. They look at them being rolled, and they actually have a myth that says that the earth actually rotated because of a giant dung beetle
that was rolling it. The Earth is a giant ball of dung. That's lovely. slime features prominently in this exhibit. Slime has a natural purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does.
What is it used for in nature?
Slime can be used with snails. Slime is used for mobility. Slime, for example, in the hagfish, which is also nicknamed the slimy eel, it's used as a defense mechanism. So it secretes it off its skin and it turns the water almost murky like jello, and so that helps save. Slime also can have some digestive properties. Robert, any other slime?
So some of the slime can actually be low in pH, so it can be somewhat acidic, and so it can be damaging or taste, you know, badly to a predator. And so there's slime molds that are single-cell organisms, which are utterly, utterly fascinating as well. So mm-hmm. I want to mention just one other thing. You know, 95% of the science that we learn happen in informal environments like this. You know, so that is relatively known now within our field. And so,
what do you mean happen in informal
environments? So when we think about science, technology, engineering, and math, we hear the collective societal lament about our inability to be competitive internationally with others.
But our kids don't know enough about science.
Exactly. We don't know enough about science. But actually, if you look at the entire expanse of an adult American, 95% of what they learn happens through experiences in museums, in zoos, in film, et cetera. And so this is a very, very important alternative, and you know, if you look closely at the data, we actually catch up as a consequence of museums and zoos.
But you're doing this in the summertime, so classes, CMS will be out of school.
Absolutely.
Correct. We won't have formal schools here. However, we do have a large visitorship of summer camps. So, number one, Discovery Place offers summer camps, so science camps, which are week-long. And then other groups bring their children here. So we have a lot of the YWCA camps, summer camp programs all throughout the state that bring their children on field trips, and not to mention then families that take vacations and come over and visit. So we will be very busy with all things gross.
Animal Grossology is at Discovery Place through Labor Day. Robert Corbin and Joni Phillip, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Privileged to be here. Thank you.
Also, thanks to the folks from the Cultural Life Task Force, Felicia McDowell of Moore and Van Allen, and Pat Riley of Allen Tate Company, who are here with us in the first part of the program, and Robert Bush from the Arts and Science Council. You can find out more about this program online. Listen to it again if you like. 90.7 WFAE, WFAE.org. This is Charlotte Talks.